Okay, so imagine that something glimmers before you. It's an interest that's dawning, and you decide, well, first of all, you're paralyzed. You think, well, how do I know if I should pursue that? It's probably a stupid idea. And the proper response to that is, you're right, it probably is a stupid idea, because almost all ideas are stupid. And so the probability that as you move forward on your adventure that you're going to get it right the first time is zero. It's just not going to happen. And so then you might think, well, maybe I'll just wait around until I get the right idea, and which people do, right? So they're like 40-year-old, 13-year-olds, which is not a good idea. And so they wait around until it's waiting for Godot, until they finally got it right. But the problem is you're too stupid to know when you've got it right. So waiting around isn't going to help, because even if the perfect opportunity manifested itself to you in your incomplete form, the probability that you would recognize it as the perfect opportunity is zero. You might even think it's the worst possible idea that you've ever heard of anywhere. Highly likely, highly likely. So you have, there's Nietzsche called that a will to stupidity, which I really liked. So because he thought of stupidity as being it, you know, it's you have to take it into account fundamentally and work with it. And so you can take these tentative steps on your pathway to destiny, and you can assume that you're going to do it badly, and that's really useful, because you don't have to beat yourself up. It's pretty easy to do it badly. But the thing is, it's way better to do it badly than not to do it at all. And that's a continual message that echoes through these historical stories in Genesis. It's like, these are flawed people. They should have got the hell out of their house way before they did. And they go out and they stumble around in tyranny and famine and self-betrayal and violence and... But it's a hell of a lot better than just rotting away at home. And that's great. So that's good. And so why is that? Well, okay, so you start your path and you think that you're heading, you know, towards your star. And so you go in that direction. And then, because you're here, the world looks a particular way. But then when you move here, the world looks different. And you're different as a consequence of having made that voyage. And so... what that means is that now that thing that glimmers in front of you is going to have shifted its location, because you weren't very good at specifying it to begin with, and now that you're a little sharper and more focused than you were, it's going to reveal itself with more accuracy to you. And so then you have to take a, you know, it's almost like a 180-degree reversal. But it isn't, because, you know, you've gone this far, and that's a long ways to get that far. But that's a lot farther than you would be if you just stayed where you were, waiting. And so it doesn't matter that you overshoot continually. Because as you overshoot, even if you don't learn what you should have done, you're going to continually learn what you shouldn't keep doing. And if you learn enough about what you shouldn't keep doing, then... that's tantamount at some point to learning at the same time what you should be doing. So it's okay. So it's like this. Now, what's cool about it, though, I think, is that as you progress, the degree of overshooting starts to decline, right? And that we know that. There's nothing hypothetical about that. As you learn a new skill, like even to play a song on the piano, for example, you overshoot madly. You're making all sorts of mistakes to begin with, and then the mistakes... They disappear. This guy came up to me last night. He was a kind of a pierced guy, rough-looking guy. And he's probably in his late 20s, maybe early 30s. He said, I've been smoking drug-free for 9 months. And I said, hey, good work, man. Because he looked pretty pleased about that. I said, well, you know, hopefully that's a lot better. And he said, it's a lot better. And I said, well, good for you for sticking it out, and I hope you can continue it. And I meant that, because I did mean good for you, and I hope you can stick it out. And he knew I meant that, because he wouldn't have bloody well told me that to begin with if he didn't think that that was going to be the response. And then he said, I got 9 of my mates to do the same thing. Yeah, I thought, right on, man, that's great. And then, you know, this, I was in Birmingham 2 nights ago, and I walked out of the hotel, and this kid, working class kid, came up to me, you know, just out of the blue, and he said, thank you very much for elevating my vision.
I thought, hey, look, it's really a good thing to be able to go around the world and to have people stop you on the street and say things like that to you. It's like, that's as good as it gets, you know? And people are telling me stories like that all the time. They come up and they say, well, you've watched this. It happens all the time. People come up and they tell me some way that their house was out of order, you know, they're hopeless and nihilistic and drinking too much and watching too much pornography and procrastinating too much and being not serious with their relationship and not getting along with their parents and, you know, not formulating a vision and not growing up. And, well, you know, there's just endless ways that you can descend into a kind of, what would you call it, a kind of grungy, filthy carpet infested hell. And then they say, look, I've been watching your lectures and I developed a plan for my life and I've been trying to be more responsible and I've been really trying to tell the truth and I mended my relationship with my father and I got married to my girlfriend and now I have a flat and I quit doing drugs and I've just tripled my salary in the last year and I didn't commit suicide like I was going to 6 months ago. I think I have, I don't know, out of the 150 people that I talk to each night, I would say probably over the course of the lecture series, there's probably 10 people like that a night who tell me that. And so, see, and because I believe what I said tonight, I believe that the individual is sovereign and that individual sovereignty is the cornerstone of reality itself, and it's the cornerstone of the state, and it's the cornerstone of reality itself. I truly believe that to be the case. That every time I hear someone say, look, I've got my act together, I think that's one more weight on, you know, if the scales are always tilting towards good or towards evil, then every time someone decides to straighten themselves up, they take a major weight off the evil side and they put it on the good side, and it's not trivial. And I believe that that's what the redemption of the world depends on. It's not political. It happens at the level of the individual. Just like the descent into totalitarian catastrophe occurs when people abandon their sovereign responsibility, which I think is the most accurate way of diagnosing what happened in the 20th century. So whenever someone comes up to me and says, I was not doing so well, and here's, you know, three ways where I've really put my life together, we have a little 15-second party, and we both know why. And so that's as good as it gets. And so that's happening constantly. And I feel, generally speaking, that these events are like they're celebrations of that. And so interesting to watch the media miss this completely. It's like they don't have the conceptual, what would you say? They don't have the conceptual tools to understand that something might be happening that's worthy of note outside the purely conventional confines of you know, the stultifying and dull political discourse. I'm a psychologist. I decided a long time ago that the individual was the right level of analysis, and so it's an absolute, it's not a pleasure. It's not the right way of thinking about it. What's rule 7? Do what is meaningful, not what is expedient. This is the most deeply meaningful thing that I can envision doing. So that's great. It's great. It's hard. Great is hard. When something great happens, that's hard, right? It's not something trivial, but it doesn't matter because it's great. And so every time someone says to me, I'm better, I'm getting along with my father, I've married my girlfriend, we're going to have a child, we weren't going to have children, now we're going to have children, I think, that's one more. So that's great, man. That.
I'm doing one thing really stupidly that I should stop doing. It's like, how long is it going to take you to figure out what that is? It's about 2 seconds, right? You've known it forever. And you could even make it less demanding. You could say, there are some stupid things that I'm doing that I know are stupid and wrong that I could stop doing, that I would stop doing. And then you can just start with that. And you can just do that. And maybe it's just a little thing, although it's not, because it's a step forward on the proper voyage. It's not a small thing. And you think, well, what would happen? You could say, let's do this for a year, or even a month. Just try not to do things you know to be stupid and wrong for a month. And that means not to say things you know to be stupid and wrong as well. Maybe that's the most important thing. Just do it as an experiment. See what happens. And it's so fun because I have people writing to me from all over the world who are saying they're doing that. They're saying, well, you know, I cleaned up my room and then I stopped saying stupid things and my God, it's like things are way better. It's like, who would have guessed it? You know? And so it's low-hanging fruit, man. Because that's the other thing. If there's a lot of things wrong with you, then it's really easy to start fixing it, you know? You've got so much territory that you can inhabit. I've had people come to me who have had very chaotic and ill-spent lives, let's say, who were in that neighborhood of age. And it's true for people who are older as well, who then decided to make a real effort and to try to make where they were better, you know, instead of being bitter about where they weren't, because that's the bitterness that really does you in. It's really not good. It's the opposite of gratitude. It's the manifestation of resentment. It makes you malevolent. It's very, very bad to be bitter. It's hell to be bitter. And if you're 40 and you're not successful, then you have to accept your lot and you have to start to improve what's right in front of you. And if you do that, it doesn't take very long. It's quite interesting to watch people. Things can be a lot better in 6 months, and they can be way better in 2 years. Like, it's a struggle, uphill struggle, but it's by no means impossible. And I don't know, again, what the limit of that is. I suppose it depends to some degree on the degree of your commitment. But anyway, so Abraham, it's another indication of the real validity of this story. God isn't setting this up to be easy, right? Abraham's old, and his wife is old, too, and more than that, she's barren. How is he going to be the father of nations? How is he going to be successful? Well, the initial departure point is insufficient, radically insufficient. And that's very inspiring because it means that you can start from where you are.
People ask me what it's like to be on tour with you.
Yeah.
I always say, well, he takes life seriously, and it's making me take life more seriously, and I think it's making these people take life more seriously. Do you remember the moment that happened?
Yes.
Can you tell me that moment?
Yes, I can. Yeah. So it was in, I think, 1983, and this is a strange story. I came home from a party, a university party, and I wasn't in the best mood. I've always had a certain proclivity towards depression, which I've recently discovered is probably an autoimmune problem. In any case, I'd gone to this party and I'd had a lot to drink because I like to drink. And I don't know, I wasn't happy with something that happened at the party. I wasn't happy with the way I behaved. I mean, that's not uncommon, right? If you like to drink, then you're not happy with the way you behave. Those things just go together. And so, but it was deeper than that. It wasn't just that I was unhappy with the way the party had gone, but I was deeply dissatisfied with how I was oriented in life. Like, I felt that there was a nihilism, I suppose, that was gnawing at me. This was not long after I'd worked for a socialist party in Canada for a while when I was a kid, and this wasn't long after I stopped doing that, and so I kind of lost my moorings, and you know, the Christianity that my mother practiced in particular, I'd abandoned that when I was like 13, and so I didn't have any structure to orient me at all, and so I was experimenting a little bit with artistic production at this point, not a lot, but a bit, and so I took out this canvas from my closet, and I sat down and I sketched out this picture, and I just let my imagination roam, and what came out was, it was a crucifixion, and there was I drew a picture of Christ on the crucifixion, but it with a very judgmental face, very angry face, and with a snake wrapped around his waist, And it was a really harsh picture. It was like an expressionist picture. Not that I have the talent of an expressionist, but that's what it was. And I thought, I wasn't thinking, I didn't think that I was thinking in religious terms at that point at all. And, I was an absolutely sporadic churchgoer. And I was absolutely shocked by this picture. I thought, what, where the hell did this come from? What did that possibly mean? It took me years to figure out what it meant. I mean, really, one thing, so I'll tell you part of what it meant. So Carl Jung said something very interesting about the structure of the New Testament. He said that the gospel Christ is fundamentally, although not entirely, fundamentally a figure of compassion. But the ideal is not only compassion. The ideal is also a judge, because an ideal is a judge. Let's say you have an ideal. Well, it's a judge because you don't live up to it. And so your ideal is always looking at you like you're not what you should be. And the higher the ideal, the more judgmental the judge. Well, that's why he thought the book of Revelation, first of all, emerged as an unconscious revelation, because Christ comes back at the end of time, so the story goes, as the ultimate judge. And virtually no one is judged acceptable. Well, why? Well, because by the highest possible, speaking psychologically, even biologically for that matter, the idea of Christ is the instantiation of the ideal as such. That's what it is. Now, it might be more than that, but that's what it is. It's whatever a human being would be if a human being was perfect. And it's an effort of our collective imagination to represent that symbolically, which we do with cathedrals, for example, when we paint the image of Christ against the dome that represents eternity itself. That's the ideal. Now, you might say, well, I don't believe in the ideal. It's like, you're missing the point. So that ideal is a judge, and the farther you are away from that ideal, the harsher the judge. And so the snake was part of that, because the thing is that if you're low enough and the ideal is high enough, the ideal itself is so judgmental and so detached for you that it starts to look to you like your enemy. And so that was the painting. And it was like, and I was asking a question, that was the thing, eh? That I was asking a question. I was asking, like, what would I have to do to set the situation that I'm in right? And so then I drew this picture, and the picture had the answer. I mean, artistic production always has the answer. That's where the answers come from, And so that was a manifestation of imagination. It was part of me attempting, in its symbolic mode of personified thinking, to deliver a message. And so I swore that night that I was going to do whatever it took to set myself right, period, whatever. And I was dead serious about that. And so that was the moment. And then I don't know what I did with that picture. I hid it in my closet because I was so freaked out by it. I thought, what the hell is this? It's like some schizophrenic nightmare. It's like underneath the covers with that thing. But it wasn't long after that that I wrote the first essay that eventually turned into this Maps of Meaning book. It was a poem to begin with, actually. That was how it came about first. So that's when I decided to straighten myself out.
If you were to pick, three rules for life that would lead you down a better path, what would they be?
Well, I think not saying things you know to be untrue. That's a good thing. Don't lie. That's good. Be grateful. And then try to work for the best in yourself and other people. And maybe even broader than that, try to work for the best despite your cynicism and resentment. I suppose that's a form of gratitude as well. That's what love means fundamentally, is working for the best of things. And it's a goal.
what's the alternative? Hate? And that's not going to make things better. It's going to make things worse. Oh, you know, generally speaking. So something like truth nested inside of love. Then there's gratitude lurking around the edges. Beauty is important.
More art, right?
Yeah, well, more beauty, period. Everywhere. That would be nice. It's kind of intimidating, beauty.
What do you mean?
But
what do you mean by that?
Well, because it's an ideal. It judges you. This is something that's quite interesting, is every ideal is a judge. Right? Because
by
you
nature.
Fall short of it. Yeah, but it's an interesting problem that you need an ideal to work towards, but the consequence of that is that you're judged by it.
That's fascinating, because we always want the ideal, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I recommend it to people that they try to reward themselves for improving over who they were yesterday, rather than punishing themselves for their deviation from the ideal. Look for incremental improvements and let yourself know that you've managed them.
Is it important to hold the ideal, but also then keep short-term goals of
yes,
you
definitely.
Against yourself?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, you want to break it down into, and you do this with kids too. You want to set someone a task that will stretch them beyond their limit, but not be impossible, right? So that's part of being intelligent and careful within a relationship. Because it'd be nice to facilitate success. I mean, maybe it has to be punctuated by failure from time to time, but that's one of the things you do as a therapist, is try to set things up so that people succeed in moving towards their goals, and try to make the tasks small enough so that they're a reasonable probability that they will be completed successfully.
Well, so we live inside a damaged structure, and we also bear responsibility for that damage, because we don't do everything we can to constantly repair it. And you might say, well, that's actually one of the fundamental, you know, people say, well, what's the meaning of life? What they really mean is, what's the positive meaning of life? Because as we've already discussed, the negative meanings of life are more or less self-evident. Well, the positive meaning of life is to be found in noting the state of lack of repair of the walled city that you inhabit, and then sallying forth to do something about that, to repair the breaches and to fix up the walls and to make the structure that you inhabit as secure and as productive as it possibly can be. And there's no shortage of opportunities to do that. You can do that in your own mind. You can do that in your own room. You can do that in your own household, in your local community. And maybe if you get good at doing it at all those levels, then you can start to look beyond that. And so there's challenges. That's the thing that's kind of interesting about this insufficient structure, is that it has a set of challenges built into it because of its insufficiency, and perhaps even because of its corrupt nature, that calls forth the potential response from you of heroic adventure. And the heroic adventure is to man the barricades and repair the city. And you can always do that. It doesn't matter what your personal circumstances are. There's always something that isn't right near you, isn't correct, isn't laid out properly, that you could just fix if you wanted to. And one of the things that we're going to talk about tonight is the idea that if you adopt the attitude, an attitude that's like that, that the role that you should play is to make things better wherever you are, however you can, that what would actually happen would be that things would get better wherever you are in all sorts of ways, and that we've really, as a species, you might say, or maybe even as singular individuals, we've explored that rarely. It isn't something that's put forth as a proposition that often, and it's quite surprising to me. And, you know, I had an interesting experience the other day. I went to the Keg. I go there because I have food allergies, and they're very careful with people who have food allergies. And the waiter took me to the table, and he said that he had been watching my lectures, and that's a very common experience. And he was happy about that, and he said that he'd had two promotions at the Keg in the last 4 months because he'd been watching my lectures. And like, I really found that an affecting experience, because, you know, you might say, well, he's working as a waiter at the keg and there's nothing particularly heroic about that. And I disagree with that, actually, because I don't care where you're located, you can do a hell of a job, and I mean that literally. At whatever job you have, you can take whatever job you have and you can make it a real nice little piece of absolute misery. Or you can act like a civilized human being and notice that no matter where you are, there's a richness and a complexity that's completely inexhaustible right at hand. And then you can take that seriously and you can say, well, I happen to be a waiter at the keg, and perhaps that's not what I expected, and he's a young guy, and perhaps that isn't where I want to end up, but it's not nothing. It's a rich environment, and I can make it a lot better if I want to. I can get along properly with my coworkers and not gossip behind their back, and I can treat my customers properly, and if an opportunity comes my way, I can take it, and I can see what happens. And so he said that's what he'd started doing, and that things were working out much better for him. He was in a much better job than he was 3 months ago. And 3 months, that's nothing, right? I mean, that's a nice trajectory. It's an uphill trajectory. And that's what you want, really. An uphill trajectory is actually even better than being somewhere good, as far as I'm concerned. Because one of the things that really makes your life meaningful is the clear realization that you're headed somewhere better than you are now. And then it's even better if you also understand that there's a direct causal relationship between the things that you're doing and the steepness of that incline. And so I get a lot of letters from people like that, and they're most frequently young men, although not always. And they say, well, you know, I've been listening to these lectures and I decided that I'm going to try to take responsibility for my life. And so I've started to stop doing all the stupid things that I know that are stupid, that I know I shouldn't be doing. And I've started doing some of the things that aren't stupid that I know I should be doing, which seems pretty obvious, really, if you think about it. But obvious though it may be, that isn't necessarily what people do. And then they write and say, you can't believe what difference that makes. And they're thrilled about it. And so I'm thrilled about it when I get letters like that, because I really don't experience anything as better than a letter like that or a message like that, because it's so good to see things that aren't so good replaced by something better. And I really do think it's an open question. I truly believe it's an open question to what degree we could make things better if that's what we actually aimed at doing. Life has a tragic element, you know, because we're vulnerable, all of us, and we know it, which is the particularly human curse, let's say. We're aware of our vulnerability, and it's not just vulnerability in the tragic sense, it's also the human proclivity for evil that makes the tragedy of life even worse than it would otherwise have to be. And you could say that that's a basic truth. You could even say that that's a basic truth with regards to the meaning of life. You know, it's a pessimistic way of looking at it in some sense, but it leads to an optimistic conclusion. All of us have to face our limitations and malevolence in the world, and the possibility that we'll be betrayed or betray other people and act improperly. And that's a heavy burden. But the truth of the matter is, as far as I'm concerned, that each of us has enough potential character, power of character, let's say, if it's properly manifested, to contend with that in a noble way and to rise above it and to transcend and to deal with it in large part, because we can make the world a much better place than it is for each of us individually and for our families and for our community. And we can constrain the malevolence, at least in our own hearts, and perhaps have a positive effect on those around us as a consequence. And that actually does make things better, and we actually can do that. And that's where the meaning in life is to be found. And that meaning, you know, that goes along with the adoption of that kind of responsibility is actually the antidote to the suffering. You know that perfectly well, because all of you need a reason to get out of bed in the morning, especially on a rough morning, you know, when things aren't going so well in your life. And there will be plenty of times when things aren't going so well in your life. And you still need a reason to get up and get moving and get out there. And if you have adopted the responsibility at an individual level to make things better, given how bad they are, if you've adopted the responsibility to make things better, then you have a reason to get up. And so one of the things that I've been stressing to people is that there's very little difference between the meaning in life that gives you fulfillment and that engages you in existence and the willingness to shoulder as much individual responsibility as you can possibly handle. Those are the same things. And that's a really useful thing to know. And you kind of know this, right? Everybody knows this because, first of all, if you're not living up to your responsibilities, even to take care of yourself, the probability that you're going to be ashamed of that at some level is extraordinarily high. And so your own soul tells you that you're in error, so to speak. But also, if you look at who you spontaneously admire, which is a good indication of where your value system really sits, you'll see that the people you admire are always people who take responsibility for themselves and responsibility for their family and responsibility for their community. You know, we're cynically, it's often considered that we admire, let's say, the rich and successful because of their status and their wealth and their power. But that's a very shallow and it's very trivial. And I also don't really believe that it's true. I think that the people we admire are people who conduct themselves admirably in life. And you get a spontaneous admiration as a consequence of that. And that's a call from the deepest reaches of your being to imitate and to follow in that pathway. And you can do that. So there are constraints on how you can interact with the world in a successful manner. Let's assume that you don't want undue pain and anxiety. We could just start with that, and I think that's a reasonable proposition. You could tolerate some pain and anxiety if it's in the service of something greater, obviously, but I just mean pointless pain and anxiety. We don't want any more of that than is necessary. And that means that you have to take care of yourself to some degree. But the manner in which you take care of yourself is severely constrained. This is partly why you have to be intelligent and careful and plot your way through life properly. You have to take care of yourself today, but you have to take care of yourself today in a way that doesn't interfere with you taking care of yourself tomorrow and next week and next month and next year and 5 years from now and 10 years from now. So you can't do just what you want to in the next hour, because if it's impulsive, pleasure-seeking, let's say, something like that, excess alcohol use or excess drug use or careless sexual behavior or betrayal of people to gain you something in the moment, you're going to pay for that. You're going to pay for it tomorrow. You're going to pay for it next week and next month and next year. And so because you're going to exist in the future and because you have to live with yourself, there's only a certain number of ways that you can act that are going to work. But it's more than that. It's not just that you're responsible to your future self or the set of all your future selves, is that you also have to act in a way that works for your family, because otherwise your family is going to disintegrate and break down and cause you and them all sorts of misery and grief. And not just your family now, but also your family into the future. And then not just your family either, but also your community. And so you have to set your aspirations so that they serve you in the broadest sense over a long period of time, and they also serve your family and they also serve your community. And that's a very tight set of constraints. And I think that the best solution to that set of constraints from a philosophical perspective, or maybe even a theological perspective, is to view the world as a place not of groups, but of individuals, of sovereign individuals who are responsible for their destinies, responsible for their families and for their communities. And that's essentially the ethos of the modern West, because the thing that's so remarkable about the West, I would say, is that we did a wonderful job of articulating out the idea of individual sovereignty, and we made that the cornerstone of our political and economic systems. And the thing about that is, it works. And the evidence that it works is, well, it's right here in this room. Everything in this room is working, right? And around the world, increasingly, people are becoming economically better off at a rate that's absolutely staggering. And a huge portion of that is because we've articulated out the ethos of the responsible sovereign individual. Now, it's not the same as the individual with rights. It's not like rights are irrelevant, but rights are really there to facilitate your adoption of individual responsibility. One of the things I would like to say to all of you, and it's one of the things I really wanted to talk about coming here today when I was thinking about it, is that you don't want to play identity politics. And that can happen because it can be played on the right and the left, right? And that's a collectivist idea. You don't want to do that. What you could bring to the table that hasn't been brought to the table for years is an emphasis on individual responsibility. And the right way to do that, as far as I'm concerned, is to start with yourselves, is develop a vision for your life. You start to think about, if you could be who you could be, what would that look like? That's the beginning of a mature philosophy of being. If you could be the person that you would admire, who would that person be? How would you configure yourself? How would you configure your career, your education, your family, your the use of time outside of work? If you wanted to be the noblest person that you could be, who was adopting the maximal amount of responsibility, how would that look? Then you need a strategy to put that into place. And that's the way you change things properly, and also the way you do the least amount of harm while you're changing them. You need a meaning to offset the tragedy of life. Otherwise, you just suffer stupidly, and you tend to make people around you suffer the same way. It's like, not good.
It's what the modern left does.
Yes,
quite well.
Well, and the way that you find that meaning is by adopting as much responsibility as you can. And what's also so fascinating about that is, you know, you're characterized by an indefinite potential. And it isn't easy to understand exactly what that is, that potential, but you know, it's what people call you on when they say, you know, you're not living up to your potential. Whatever that is, that potential will be called forth from you as a consequence of adoption of responsibility, because it won't manifest itself unless you take on a load. You're not going to develop in all the ways you could develop unless you set yourself a serious challenge, because it takes the challenge to pull that out of you and also to motivate you to rid yourself of all the weaknesses and personality flaws that you've accumulated across the years and to let those disappear and burn off you. You need to load yourself up before the demands of life will be such that you will discipline yourself properly. And a noble goal is a very good way of beginning that. Get your act together. You've got things to do in the world. The absence of your full being in the world leaves a hole that is filled by terrible things. At minimum, you have an ethical responsibility to ensure that the world doesn't devolve into something approximating hell. And at maximum, you have the responsibility, again, the ethical, and it's a heavy ethical responsibility, to do everything that's in your power to make things as good as you can possibly make them in this sophisticated manner that takes you and your family and your community into account. And it's on you, right? And that's meaning, you know. People say, well, I'd like to have a meaningful life. It's like, well, fair enough, but the price that you pay for the meaning that transcends tragedy is the adoption of responsibility for the catastrophe of existence. But that ennobles you, right? It makes you into someone strong and someone competent and someone who's worthwhile and who lives in a manner that justifies their own suffering. And that's what, there's nothing better than you could possibly do than that. I bought this cottage up north in northern Canada, and it's very dark up there. And you can go onto the dock at night, and it's dark enough so you can see the Milky Way, you know, and it has to be pretty dark before you can see the Milky Way. And it's very impressive. You know what that's like if you've been out to see the night sky, or maybe you feel the same way when you see the Grand Canyon or a remarkable waterfall or some particularly beautiful scene, or perhaps you feel that way in a cathedral, or more likely you feel that way when you're listening to music that really grips you, right? And it's all the same experience. It's an experience of awe, and it's way down low in your nervous system, like the orienting reflex. It's not a cognitive response precisely. It's a precognitive emotional response that signifies significance. And you look up at the night sky, and it fills you with a sense of awe. But it doesn't just do that. You see, it activates the impulse to imitate, which is a very deep motivation in human beings. We're unbelievable mimics. We mimic each other all the time, which is why we all use the same words, let's say. We're very good at embodying other people's embodiments. It's a particular talent that human beings have, and we're so good at that that we imitate all sorts of things that aren't even human. And so then you view this expansive night sky, and a sense of awe fills you as you confront the infinite. And it calls to something inside of you that can master the infinite. And that's a form of imitation, right? To look into the darkest place, the most wide expanse possible, and to have something inside you respond that's capable of dealing with that. That's that instinct to imitate. And that's calling the best out of you, and that's why you love doing that. And it isn't just that you love it, it's that you cannot live without it. You cannot live without it. And I know so many of you, atheist or otherwise, you can't live without music. You think, why can you not live without music? And what is it calling to precisely? You know, that remarkable interplay of harmonious patterns, because that's what music is and that's what the world is. It's not objects, it's the harmonious interplay of patterns, and music reflects that, and then you orient yourself in your embodied manner to those patterns and dance along with the world, and that revivifies you. And if you're particularly good at, well, maybe you'll also attract a mate, and you want a mate that doesn't attempt to dominate you sexually during the introductory dance, right? You want a mate who will play along with you and match your movements to theirs so that you can see that there's a harmonious interplay between the two of you as you meet in play, soul to soul, if you can manage it. And that capacity that's called out in the dance is the same capacity that's called out by the night sky, and it's the same thing that's represented in those Byzantine churches. You look deep enough into infinity and you find your destiny. And that destiny is everything you could be. And we all know that because, and this is what men and women search for in each other. You know, if you're rejected by a woman, well, why is she rejecting you? Well, maybe her judgment is off, and that would be very, what would you say, convenient for you. But she's rejecting you because you are not all that you could be, and maybe not even all that you need to be. And so that's a very painful rejection, and it causes all sorts of tension between men and women. But, you know, women have a lot at stake in this game. And so they're looking for something, what, powerful, dominating, brutal, terrible? No. Something perhaps capable of that, but even more important, capable of mastering it, right? And capable of singing despite that. We all know that's true, and the shame that men feel when they're rejected by women is precisely the shame that they feel at knowing deep in their heart that they have not lived up to what they are capable of being. And that harsh judgment that women lay on men, which, by the way, is part of our sexual evolution, because we were shaped by sexual selection, which, by the way, is the operation of consciousness on the structures of matter at the most basic possible level. Well, it's a terrible rejection, but it's a salutary rejection. And that process of differentiated choice has shaped us into what we are. That action of consciousness, wanting the best from a potential partner, and selecting at least in part on that basis. And men participate in that too, in the Meistersinger manner. You know, men aren't competing for dominance with each other constantly in a zero-sum game to achieve sexual dominance. There's an element of that, right? Because some things are a zero-sum game, but men are perfectly capable and more than willing, in fact, to aggregate themselves into skilled groups and to celebrate the elevation of the most skilled above all else. And so we see this cooperative venture between men and women over the longest run of possible time in producing some refinement of the human spirit in embodied form. And we want that from everyone. We require that from everyone. We're thrilled to the core of our soul when we encounter it in a conversation or in a course, or in a work of art that calls to us in that manner. We need to know this increasingly. We need to know all this consciously. You know? We've acted it out. We've produced images to represent it. It tugs at our heartstrings. It manifests itself in our dreams and our works of art, our literary works. It's all lurking there in some sense. And it's not the satanic power of corrupt oppression, not fundamentally. That's a far weaker force than that which can overcome it. And everything around us would be nothing but hell if that's all there was. And everything around us is not only hell. No, for fragile and broken creatures, ignorant to the core, we don't do too badly. And people are capable of a nobility, especially under the duress of suffering, that's virtually miraculous when you encounter it. And it's so heartening to see that. And you've seen it in the people that you love when they're going through terrible trials. You know, people become corrupt and embittered by their catastrophes, and it's no wonder. But certainly in the main, that's not the fundamental human response. The fundamental human response is keep calm and carry on, you know? And good on you for that. So, well, to sum up, let's say, we solve the power of perception with the divine word. That's how it is. And what does that mean? Well, it means truth. Every word a prayer, right? Every word a groping to find a firm foundation to stand on while you make your way through life. And every time you hear a conversation of that sort, or hear yourself participating in that prayerful process, orienting yourself to this highest uniting good and using that to govern your utterance, it's balm for the soul. Yeah, it's love that guides that, and love is the desire to work for the betterment of all things. And that's the proper orienting response, we could say. And it's truth nested inside of that. And that's how it is. And that's how it should be. And that's how it may forever be.
What would you say from your personal experience has been one of the most consistent issues that you see plaguing young men and holding them back from all your years of experience?
Well, one of them is wrong attitude towards education. Mm. And, you know, because it's easy. Like I said, temperamentally, I was disinclined to enjoy school, especially from grade 7 through grade 12, especially
Why do you say
junior
that?
High. Well, all my friends were kind of delinquent types in some ways, and so they acted up, and so did I, and I was pretty mouthy. But also, it was too slow for me. You know, like when I took language arts in grade 8, I had read the whole year's books in the first, I think it was the first day, but it was certainly the first week. And so It just bored me. I was just bored to death. So that wasn't so good. And, you know, it can be a bit infantilizing because of the rule structure. Like I said, a lot of my friends, they just weren't going to put up their hand when they wanted to go to the bathroom anymore. And they were just done with that. But one of the things young men aren't taught properly, and I mean even at the age of, let's say, 11, young, is like there is nothing that will make you more powerful than your words. And so if you think that reading and writing is for pansies and dimwits, you know, or teachers' pets, because they get in less trouble in school, let's say, you're seriously misinformed. And so, you know, I talk to people like Jocko Willink, and Jocko's as tough a guy as you could ever hope to encounter about literacy, and a number of other people too who are also seriously tough guys. Congressman Dan
Crenshaw.
Crenshaw, yeah. Yeah, well, he's as tough as a bloody boot, that guy, you know. And both those characters, and Rex Murphy, who's one of Canada's outstanding journalists, another, he's so damn tough, it's crazy. And they all know perfectly well that literacy is a huge part of what's made them unstoppable. And you don't take that lightly. You know, it's really serious. And it's a failing of our education system that it's not, that literacy isn't marketed properly to young men. It's like, straighten up, speak properly, write, learn to write. Why? Because that's the same as learning to think. And why should you think? Mm. Well, because you won't do as many stupid things and your horizons will widen. And then too, when you need to entice people along your journey, hopefully somewhere good, you'll be able to do it because you'll be compelling. And there's something deeply pathological about the way our society markets literacy to young men in particular, because, well, partly we just won't allow for the
let's say, the marketing association between toughness and dangerousness and literacy. There's something wrong about that, we think, some weird way. And that's wrong. It's like, sure, you should be physically tough and you should be tough in your temperament, as well as having the capacity for play and compassion. You know, that has to be developed too. But that's not enough. And I don't care how tough you are physically, you're nowhere near as tough as you would be if you were physically tough and really literate. And then you're an unstoppable force, and hopefully for good. And that's a much tougher battle than, you know, being tough for your own idiotic, selfish ends. That's just pathetic. And I just don't understand. We've developed a writing program, which is called Essay, which teaches people how to write while they use it. It's a word process, but it teaches people how to write as you use it. We built that into the program itself. And I really want to market it to young men and say, look, you know, get your words together and then see what you can do. And don't be thinking that that's somehow beneath you. That just means you're stupid that you think that. You don't know anything. You think that. It's wrong. And you're limiting yourself so much you can't even imagine it. You might not even figure it out till you're 60 and then it's too late. So read, write, think. Right. That's what we need. We got together with the woman who was going to become my wife, Tammy. I mean, I've known her since we were 8, and she was a friend of mine when I was a kid, and so we've known each other forever. But we got together seriously when we were in our late 20s, and she was really ready to have a family, like now. And I didn't have a permanent job at that point, although my prospects were good, which is part of the reason she married me. But she wanted to start, and I thought, okay, so I didn't really want to do that. And I thought, okay, what's your problem, Jordan? What is it that you're worried about? And I thought, well, there's an economic issue. That that's not really serious. I'll get a job, and she'll come along wherever I go if I have that job. So that's not an issue. It's like, so what then? Well, babies. What the hell do I know about babies? Nothing. I can't take care of a baby. I don't know how to do that. So I said to her, well, the reason I seem to be objecting is because I'm kind of doubtful about the infant stage. Like toddlers, I know what to do with them. I can play with kids. But when they're under a year, they're like a foreign object to me in many ways. I don't know what to do. And so that worries me. And so I'll tell you what, if you'll take primary care for the infant, I'll take care of you and the infant. And how would that be? And I think that's the right role. I really do believe that. And you might think, well, that's sexist. It's like, well, no, not necessarily. How are you so sure that that first year as a mother isn't one of the great parts of the fundamental adventure of being female? Like, so don't give me any crap about that being sexist. That's just, I don't think so. You know, and so what I would do is watch my wife, and if she got tired, spell her off. And I did what I could to take care of the infant, but I knew that, you know, she would take care of that. Well, I stumbled around trying to learn how, and she did that, and that worked fine. And then, you know, as the kids got older, I took more and more responsibility for them. And when my daughter was about 2.5, I think that's right, 1.5, we had our second child. And then I took care of Michaela, the older child, quite a lot after that, because Tammy, of course, was busy, especially that first year with the infant, with Julian. But that worked well. That was a good division of labor as far as I was concerned. And also my wife was very happy about that because she loved to take care of infants. And that's characteristic of a lot of women, you know, and even those that don't admit it. And it's too bad they don't admit it, because what, there's something wrong with that? Is there some? I saw this tweet the other day about this grandmother, mother of a mature daughter. And the daughter had announced that she was never going to have kids. And her mother said, oh, I think that's just great. You know, you're gonna just live for you, and that's just wonderful, and I'm glad you can be so independent. And I thought, how could you possibly say something that stupid to your daughter? It's like, you don't want grandchildren? And you're so sure that she's just not ideologically addled about the fundamental realities and beauties and depth of life? It's like, how many things do we do? We have a career if we're lucky, or a job if we don't. If we're not, we have an intimate relationship, we have a family. That's life, man. You miss one of those, it's, well, you can do it, but it's It's a big deal not to do that. You know, you think that the pleasures that wealth can bring you as a solitary and free individual outweigh the terrible, you know, burdensome responsibility of a family. But if you're just thinking of that responsibility as burdensome, you're not thinking straight. It's like, no, you don't understand. That's a wonderful opportunity. That's what that is. And it comes at a cost, like all opportunity. And you see that too. One of the saddest things I saw fairly regularly as a clinician was, you know, couples that had decided too late that they wanted to have kids and then, you know, were just turning themselves inside out with attempts to conceive and often failing. And Jesus, you know, that's hard to recover from once you realize that's what you want and it doesn't happen. So don't. And the other thing that people don't really realize is that things go by pretty quick. You know, that period of time when your kids are little, it seems like a long time when you think about it beforehand, and even sometimes when you're living through it, but it's gone, and you want to take advantage of that. And I had a great career, and I still do, but I can't say that it was more important to me, like, existentially, than my family. Like, I couldn't have possibly imagined having a career that was more, what would you say? It offered me everything I could have possibly wanted. Also a lot of trouble, but but nonetheless, and so I was exceptionally fortunate in that regard. But nonetheless, if I had to pick, like, I picked my family. Yeah, because of the quality of the experience, you know, that I'm not just saying that out of a sense of obligation or duty. It's like, no, it fundamentally, that was deeper. And I tried to teach the deepest things I could conceptualize and succeeded in that, at least to the degree that I could conceptualize them. But still, you know, it's like, no, when push comes to shove, especially those years I spent with Tammy in Boston when our kids were little, it's like, man, there is something to that. Don't miss it. Stupid guys, don't miss that. One thing my dad did for me, and my mom played a role in this, but it's harder to say exactly what it was. My relationship with my mother was much easier. She's an easy person to get along with, an easy person to love. She also has a great sense of humor, so I could always make her laugh, and that was wonderful. But my dad had extremely high standards, and it was difficult to please. And so I had this strange sense from him that I could do, that he was confident that I could do anything, but that nothing I did was ever quite good enough. And so there's a roughness to that, you know, but there's also an advantage. And it's a tough one, because when you love your kids, hey, there's two things you do for them. One's more maternal, I would say, and one's more paternal. Although either parent could play the role. The maternal is love, you know, it's like, I love you just the way you are. I think you're great. And that's what you have for babies. And you know, and that's the kind of love that makes you always welcome at home in some sense, no matter what you've done. But the paternal love is sort of like, I love you, but there could be more to you. And so it's, in its best form, it's encouragement. And to know someone has your back, and I've always known that my parents had my back, and it's a big deal. And, you know, part of what I see that affects me so profoundly emotionally when I go lecture, for example, is I see so many young people who don't have that, you know, who've never really heard a word of encouragement. And God, that's such a lack. I was so fortunate in that. How did I balance marriage, fatherhood, and a demanding career? Well, I stopped wasting time. That helped a lot. I stopped drinking. I stopped going to bars. I really didn't spend a lot of time with my friends when I had young kids in particular. I had friends and I saw them, you know, with some degree of regularity, but where I cut corners was more with social life outside my family. So I spent a lot of time with my wife and I spent a lot of time with my kids and I spent a lot of time on my career. And so you have to make choices.
And I think those were reasonable choices. I'm not displeased with them. Don't abandon your friendships, but you can certainly look at where you're wasting time and just stop doing things that you know to be a waste of time. So, and I did. And so I had enough room for my marriage, and I had enough room for my kids, and I had enough room for my career. And, you know, sort of a multidimensional career. And it was always a challenge to me, too, to see how efficient I could get. And you could also, and I've really recommended this for relatively higher income, dual income couples who are trying to pursue dual careers, kids, and marriage. You can outsource, you know, hire a cleaning lady if you can afford it. Buy restaurant food if you can afford it, etc. No, you can outsource. You can have someone do your laundry. Then you can concentrate on your marriage and your kids. I know that, you know, is only an avenue available to people who have relatively high incomes, but people who have dual incomes have relatively high incomes. And so outsource what's unnecessary so that you can concentrate on what's necessary. I mean, I didn't do that when I was beginning my career, because when I lived in the United States, when I was in my late 20s and starting my family, we had one income. You'd think a Harvard beginning professor makes a lot of money, and I suppose that's true in some absolute sense, but relatively speaking, you know, we didn't have enough money to buy magazines. We all our money went for housing cost and the basic necessities of living. I had a car that was 20 years old, 25 years old, I think. It was old. It was a bloody thing. The doors fell apart on the person I sold it to, you know, like 6 months down the road. They knew it was a wreck at that point, but we drove that thing right into the ground. So I know that's not necessarily possible for everyone at the beginning of their career, but if you have two incomes, you can manage it. I concentrated on my marriage and making time for it. I concentrated on spending time with my kids consciously, and I concentrated on developing my career. Those were the three elements of my life, and I had some time left over for creative pursuits and for friends, but most of it was a matter of getting rid of time wastes of any sort, you know, and I just pushed that out of my life, you know, day after day until I wasn't wasting any time.
You have to set up your vision, like Geppetto when he's looking at the star before Pinocchio's transformation takes place. You have to set up your long-term vision. You have some vision of the good towards which you're working, and some vision perhaps of the hell that you're avoiding. And then I would say, once you set up that vision so that you know how to orient yourself, then you should start designing your days. And you can do that very effectively with a calendar like Google Calendar. And instead of, many people say, well, I hate using a schedule, and or I hate using a calendar. And what I would say about that is that if you hate using a schedule or a calendar, then you're probably using it wrong. What you're doing is using the calendar as an external tyrant that's telling you what you should do if you were going to be a conventionally good person each day. So you load yourself up with arbitrary, we'll say, arbitrary responsibilities. But that's not really how you should use a schedule. What you should use a schedule to do is to design the day that you would most like to have. And obviously that's going to include accepting some responsibility and undertaking to make progress on those things that you have to make progress on to keep your life from collapsing into chaos. But it should also mean that you schedule in activities that make you actually want to have that day. And so if you're using a schedule properly, that it can be your friend. And that can also be something that can increase your capacity to concentrate. And then I would say, well, if you're very scattered, then you can start to train yourself. You might say, well, I need to learn to read without distraction. So maybe what you do, you say, okay, well, for the next week, I'm going to read 10 minutes a day, and I'm going to try to limit the distractions. And if you're successful at that, then you could try 12 minutes a day. And if you're successful at that, you could try 15 minutes a day. And the trick is to set a goal for yourself that is slightly beyond your current level of performance, enough to be challenging, enough to be worthwhile if you accomplished, but not so difficult that you're likely to fail.
I plan my day obsessively. My calendar is always absolutely full and often weeks in advance. And I plan in the morning, especially when I'm on top of things. And I plan each hour, and I probably plan each minute. And yes, it leads to way higher productivity. You know, you You decide what your goals are going to be. You place them in the calendar. Use the calendar as your friend, eh? Because what you want to do with the calendar is design a day that you want to have, or a day that would be good for you. And a day that would be good for you is one that you know, when you end the day, you feel that you've moved yourself ahead towards your valued goals, and that you've kept chaos under control, and that enables you to sleep soundly and with a good conscience, and to know that the next day is going to be at least not worse than that day. Planning is unbelievably useful. You need to figure out what it is that you're aiming at and why, and then you need to figure out how you're going to break that down over the months and the weeks and the days. But I would approach your calendar like it's your best friend. You think, okay, I'm going to design a week, man, that I really want to have. And that means you can schedule in leisure and all the things that you want to do, which you absolutely should do. Learning to plan is unbelievably useful to schedule your time, because that's your life, you know. But schedule the life you want. That means you have to schedule your responsibilities often, obviously, because responsibilities are those things that ruin your life if you don't fulfill them.
Learn to use a calendar, like Google Calendar. Most of you, many of you out there, do not use a calendar. Okay, a calendar is not a prison, and it's not a tyrant. Not if you use it properly. A calendar keeps anxiety at bay. It makes sure that you do what you need to do, which is important, because otherwise you fall behind. But if you use it properly, it's also helps you plan what you want to do. So I could say, well, lay out your damn calendar and design the days you would like to have. That's what your calendar is for. So you can put in all sorts of things in there you want to do and that would be good for you. And that's a really good way to start being more industrious. Make a plan. You need a plan for 3 years. You need a plan for the next year. You need a plan for the next 6 months. You need a plan for the next 3 months. You need a plan for the week. You need a plan for the day. You need a plan for the hour. All of that. I make lists constantly of what I have to do. And they're like daily, weekly, monthly, yearly. You know, I've asked my undergraduates frequently how much time they waste per day. And general estimates are like 6 to 8 hours of time they regard themselves as wasting. Like, that's a whole career right there, right? So if you just stop wasting time, you can do a tremendous amount, especially if you also try to maximize efficiency. And I always found that incredibly motivating, you know, a motivating game. How much can I do in the least amount of time possible? That's fun to try to do that, as far as I'm concerned. I know, you know, that's maybe undoubtedly a temperamental thing, but if you're wired that way, that's a great meta strategy. Become efficient. I always asked my graduate students when they were designing experiments, they'd come with a proposal. I'd say to them, you know, is there any way you could do this 10 times faster? What would you have to cut? What would you have to change to do this 10 times faster? And you can learn to do that. I also learned to force the task to fit the time. You know, there's this dictum, work expands to fill the time allowed for its completion. Work expands to fill the time allowed for its completion. Well, there's a corollary to that, which is work becomes more efficient in proportion to the restrictions of time placed upon it. So if you say, well, this could take me 2 weeks, but I'm going to do the best job I could in 1 day, you'd be amazed. You can get 90% of the way, or 95% of the way, or sometimes even farther in that day. So that's another way of becoming efficient. You know, if you only have 10 minutes to do something that should maybe take you 2 hours, maybe you can figure out how to do it in 10 minutes. You can get dreadfully efficient. So that's very much worthwhile, in my estimation, if you want to do a lot of things. What else are you going to do? You know, rather than become efficient, if you want to do many things, you don't have much choice. But I found it extremely entertaining to try to do that.